Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Cliff Thornton. He's a former SNET manager who got involved in drug policy a number of years ago. Welcome, Cliff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
And I understand that you got involved because you started a radio program at WWUH with your wife.
Yeah, that was about 5 years ago. We started doing a radio show. Originally, I started doing a jazz show, and I was looking for something for me and my wife to do, and we started to do a public affairs program. We did things like abortion, race relations, domestic violence. We even interviewed prominent candidates that were running for office at that particular time. But and we must have done maybe 15 or 20 shows. And what we found that with everything we picked up, somehow it led back to drugs. So we thought we had something. We did a show about just drugs in America. And from that show, we garnered quite a bit of feedback from the listening audience wanting to know more. So we put together a series of three shows, 1 hour apiece. The first one dealt with the history of drugs in America. The second one dealt exclusively with the economics, the monies that we were spending to fight this war on drugs. And the third one concentrated on the crime and violence associated with the drugs. Well, from that, it took on a life of its own. People were asking us to come and lecture and to all various groups. And from that, a newsletter was generated, and at its apex, there were something like 4,000 people throughout the world. Most of the people, however, were in New England and Connecticut. And
you're based in West Hartford.
We're based in, really, in Windsor.
Windsor. Okay. So, and you were doing this program out of West Hartford at WWH.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
And so then, when did Efficacy get started? Efficacy is the Connecticut lobby that you started around these policy questions.
Yeah, Efficacy was the name of our public affairs program. It's a name that we picked out because it means efficacy is the power to produce a desired effect. And the effect that we wanted to produce was peace. And it just fit perfectly. So that was our slogan, and it started to grow. At present, like I said, we have a mailing list of over 4,000. We have a listserv that covers about 600 or 700 people who get instantaneous news about drug policy and the goings on. Especially, it's going crazy now because of the stepped up intervention in Colombia.
Oh, yeah, definitely the foreign policy connection.
Right.
Now, you're also a board member of NORML, the National Organization for Marijuana Legalization.
Yes, I am. I was approached about a year ago to be on their board because what is happening, even though minorities are suffering the most because of this drug war, they are rather reluctant, let's say, to speak out about it because we all know that when you start talking about the drug war, people become scared. They're looking at this thing called legalization and it scares them to death.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. You're African American, and African American. When I started getting involved in drug policy reform issues back in the early '90s or late '80s, mm-hmm. The African American community was pretty solidly opposed to any discussion of that topic. Mm-hmm. And I think for interesting reasons, because that a lot of whites don't understand that there is substantial evidence that the CIA has turned a blind eye to the importation of drugs into African and American communities over the last 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way back to the Tuskegee experiment and a kind of history of suspicion of these initiatives. So, you know, what do you see change in African? Is your own participation kind of emblematic of a broader change in African American opinion?
Well, I don't know if it's a broader change. However, what I'm finding when I look at the drug policy reform movement right now, which numbers about maybe 200,000, there is about, I would say, pretty close to 100 African Americans thoroughly entrenched in drug policy reform throughout the country. Hmm. However, it is not to the magnitude that it should be, but it's growing by leaps and bounds. And there is reason to believe why, reason to understand why the African American community isn't in it, and some of those reasons you have mentioned. However, African Americans are beginning to see, as well as Latinos and other minorities, that the people that are going to jail are minority people. When we start to look at the whole situation and understand it thoroughly, 80% of all the illegal drugs that come into this country are consumed by the white majority. But when we start looking at sentencing, we see that almost 75% of those people that are put in jail are minority, with almost half being black. And but we can't readily say that it is thoroughly racist, because with all the people that are in the prison industrial complex, and we're not just talking about the 2 million people that are in prison, there are over 6.5 million people that are either on probation, parole, or in prison. And the common thread that runs through all of that is they're all from the same socioeconomic class. Mm-hmm. So that tells you a lot. So when you talk about race, we just can't talk about black and white or Latino and white or Latino, black and white. We have to talk about the class structure also.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in other words, more African Americans are being penalized for participation in the drug economy because they are part of the working class and they don't have access to the same legal resources that whites use to get out of their legal problems.
That is correct.
Now, you also have a very personal connection. A lot of folks have attacked me over the years, and I'm sure attacked other folks in the drug policy reform movement, for just being thoughtless libertarians who just want to have everybody have their rights to take drugs and don't understand the consequences of drug abuse. And you have a personal experience with this.
Well, not knowing, this started for me, and I'm 56 years old, just this month, January 16th. It started for me 2 weeks before I was to graduate from high school, when my mother died from an overdose of heroin. And I thought at that particular time that all drugs should be eradicated from the face of the earth, especially the drug that killed my mother, heroin. But as I watched as the decades flew by, I began to realize, and I started to ask the questions, what were we doing wrong? Because more and more people were using drugs, more and more people were going to jail. Our economic, our educational, and our health system, they were starting to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to look at the problem for what it is. People have to come to the understanding that, first of all, you're not going to get people from stop using drugs. It's not going to happen. Drugs are us, if we're honest. Because in this 1996 path-breaking book, The Chemistry and Mind-Altering Drugs, The History, The Pharmacology, and the Cultural Context, as well as other scientific articles, says that through the evolution of man, we digested many of these plants, and over a period of that evolution, we have developed receptor sites within our brain that these drugs fit like keys do a lock. So, in other words, this is an assault on human nature.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand what drugs are about, look at them rationally, and treat them accordingly.
I'm speaking with Cliff Thornton. He's the founder of the Connecticut Lobby Efficacy, a lobby for drug policy reform, and a board member for the National Organization for Marijuana Legalization. That's a very interesting point, because actually some of the ethological research has shown that some animals have evidence of altering their consciousness, spinning around, drinking fermented berries. That this is not just something that we evil, demented human beings cooked up.
Oh, no. And since you brought that up, if you would look, there's this river in Africa that every year there's just tons of fruit. And the animals purposely wait until this fruit, after it falls on the ground, ferments so they can go and get altered states. It's hilarious.
Yeah. A lingering effect of American Puritanism here in New England, it's a particularly interesting place to reflect on this. It seems like everything is pervaded by this sense that all human problems require just more effort, that for us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, apply ourselves harder, more work ethic, and we don't need any of these extraneous substances. Do you think that it's Puritanism, or is there larger economic conspiracy at work to the British prison industrial complex and so forth?
Well, we have to be realistic. As I said, if we use rationale and use the realistic approach, we'd eventually come to some consensus here. Now, let's just remember what I'm saying here. When I say that legitimate economic investment can never be more profitable than prohibition-induced drug trafficking or cultivation. And what I mean by that is this. It costs 10 cents to produce a pill of ecstasy. Yet and still, that pill can be sold at one of these raves for $20 to $30. Now let's look at heroin. It costs $90 to produce a pound of heroin. But by the time it hits the streets of, let's say, Windsor or Hartford or any other city in this country, it's worth $80,000 upwards. Now let's look at cocaine. Cocaine costs $1,500 to produce a pound of it. But by the time it hits the streets, it's worth the same thing as the heroin. So how are we going to come to grips with this?
Now, you're saying that we can't just teach these Colombian farmers to grow rice and they convince them that it's better to grow rice than cocaine?
Look, I know everybody that's listening to this program will make a 10-cent investment, will make a $90 investment, will make a $1,500 investment to get that type of return over a 6 to a 9 month period.
Absolutely.
That's impossible to escape.
Yeah. And what you're saying is that because the drugs are illegal, that's why the profits are there.
That is correct. Because when you don't regulate and control or legalize them, then the black market sets the price.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that people don't point out is all the violence that's associated with the drug trade. Allegedly, these drug traffickers are shooting each other, and they are shooting each other.
Yes.
And allegedly, all these people are getting high and shooting each other. Now, that's more alleged because generally, when you get high, you're not as likely to shoot other people.
There's no truth to that. There's very little truth to that.
But let's talk about violence, the effects of drug-related violence, and the cause of illegality as a cause of that violence.
Well, what causes the violence primarily is, let's look at the drug cartels. Now, you know the money that can be made from this. And one, let's say, drug cartel in Colombia, Bolivia, wherever the case may be, decides that they're going to start coca production or heroin poppy production. Now, the group that is already established, they're not going to want this to happen because they want to control the market. And that's where you have all of these wars going on. But let's just bring it home quickly. Now, if you ever looked at PBS or these crime shows that they have on TV, and the drug dealers are being interviewed, there was one drug dealer on there. He was selling, I think it was either crack, cocaine, or heroin. I'm not sure what the drug was, but he said in an hour, he made something like $6,000 in an hour. Now, how many people in this country can make $6,000 that don't have an education, that don't have a job, and that don't have the wherewithal to do these things. How are you going to stop people from trying to garner that much money in that short period of time when all you see on TV and all that's portrayed in the media is people who are well-to-do? That's what we're aspiring to do. This is part of the American dream.
Especially when our education system and economy are failing half the kids in this country.
And see, when you start connecting the dots, you'll find that why these systems are failing, it's not because drugs may be the direct cause of their failure, but you'll find that this drug problem works hand in hand with it. Mm-hmm. Most, if not all, of our social problems are connected to the drug problem, whether it be from an economic base, a public health base, or a direct base.
Well, there's a direct trade-off in a lot of state budgets between funding the prison industrial complex and its expansion and criminal justice.
You're hitting on it right away.
Or education.
When we start connecting the dots, then we will better understand what a tremendous problem this drug problem is in this country. And not just in this country, but throughout the world. This particular drug problem has grown from a nickel and dime of items sold in relatively unimportant markets in the 1930s to an overarching $450 billion a year underground market that affects most of our international policy and all of our domestic policy.
Let's talk for a second about marijuana, because one of the things that's stricken me and really been striking to me over the years, mm-hmm. is the evidence that the interdiction, the relatively successful interdiction of marijuana over the last 30 years, has driven folks who would have smoked marijuana or had been smoking marijuana in the past towards crack or towards other more easily hideable drugs, less easily discoverable drugs, which have far more serious consequences. And I see a direct medical argument and public health argument that you can make for marijuana legalization as a separate and probably a political issue that's more easily attainable than the legalization and decriminalization of some of the other drugs. Do you see it in the same way?
Well, let me just approach it from this way. What happened during the late 70s, early 80s, is that there was less cocaine coming into this country. What happened? What hit the street? Crack. When they safely, let's say, interdicted cocaine or got it to the point where there was so little coming through, another drug was invented.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's look at the interdiction of marijuana. Okay, they safely sealed our borders from having a lot of marijuana coming into this country. But what you have now today, a couple of entrepreneuring former college students got together. They were chemistry majors. They separated the genes between the two best marijuana plants and produced a hybrid, which is really a powerful form of marijuana. Not that it's going to send you crazy or anything, but the big thing is now most of the marijuana that's smoked in this country today does not come from outside of this country. There are literally thousands of apartments throughout this country that uses a technique called hydroponics that grow this marijuana, and nobody's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
The largest industry in Northern California, apparently.
Right, right. it outsells soy and corn.
Mm-hmm. But now I think, do you agree with me that the public, who are not involved in drug policy issues, that they make a mental distinction? I see this in my work with college students. They make a very strong distinction between the risks and social exposure and difficulties that they might get into with marijuana and the risks of other drugs. So do you think that marijuana legalization is a kind of a wedge that we might be able to use to get to open up this policy issue?
Well, the only thing I can say about this is that there's two or three facets to marijuana. Okay, within the marijuana family, you have the hemp. Now, if hemp was legalized, hemp would immediately revolutionize two industries, the garment industry and the paper industry. Mm-hmm. And that has far-reaching ramifications, which we can't go into right now. But when there is a distinction that people make between the softer drugs and the harder drugs, marijuana would probably be harder to legalize, let's say, than having heroin medicalized and cocaine medicalized because of those two things I just mentioned. Being clear?
Well, let's talk about medicalization, because that's, I don't think most people are familiar with that term. When we say medicalized, you're meaning that, as in England, that people will be able to demonstrate that they were already addicted to the substance, mm-hmm, and be able to be prescribed it, which is different, very different from being legalized.
That is very true, and that's just what I'm talking about. Because people have to understand that when we're looking at these three drugs that we're talking about, marijuana, heroin, and cocaine, out of those three, possibly heroin is the most benign. And I say this because when you look at pure heroin does not destroy body tissue. When a person can use heroin, pure heroin, all of their lives and never show the ill effects, with exception maybe constipation. Now, and a person under medically supervised heroin can carry on just like you or I, and no one would ever know the difference. Now, when you're talking about marijuana is a drug that will stop most pain. It has true medicinal use. I mean, just like all of the drugs that we're talking about, but marijuana is not something that is addictive to 99% of the population, and it's not as harmful, because in the history of mankind, no one has directly died from ingesting marijuana.
Yeah. Now, cocaine has many consequences. If you snort it, you can get sepsis in the nose, it has the long-term use of stimulants can have all the consequences of amphetamine abuse. So you're drawing a distinction between the medical consequences of stimulants and the opiates
right,
being more benign.
Of those three drugs, cocaine is the most dangerous, but even that has shown tremendous promise. There was a study that was done this past summer, I might add, that brought in, I think it was 300 hardcore cocaine addictions. And what they did was they used acupuncture, and it had a 70% cure rate as far as getting rid of the addiction. Now, that sample study is much too small to say this is the way we're going to go. I think it has to be more experimentations done with it, as opposed to heroin, which is proven over once they bring in these heroin addicts, which they did in Switzerland, they brought in something like 3,000 of them, and they stabilized their dosage, and over a period of time, they started to wean them off of it. Highly successful rate.
So, again, one of the arguments that we can make for drug legalization is the public health argument, that if you want folks who are taking these drugs to come in, see public health officials, not spread HIV through sharing of needles, mm-hmm, not give birth to kids who have drug problems because they never sought prenatal care because they are afraid to, then you have to decriminalize these folks so that they are not afraid to enter into public health.
And see, the other thing that we have to understand, that you talk about prenatal care. My brother, who is now 48, was born addicted to heroin. And during that time, they knew very little about it, how to deal with it. He carries on a normal life today. Early when he was young, it was hard to deal with. I'm talking about 2 or 3 years old. But eventually, you grow out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was the scare with the crack thing.
Right.
That hasn't materialized either.
It's so difficult to separate the different causes of why a kid might be hyperactive when they're growing up in a severely depressed home with little stimulation, et cetera, et cetera. You pull these kids in, and, of course, they're all going to look hyperactive. But, they change after time.
Right. And see, you being a sociologist, you know that there are unlimited variables as to why people act the way in which they do.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just pin it on one thing. It may be one thing or a combination of things.
Let's talk about the political climate, because there's a I taste in the most recent reporting of the Ashcroft Senate confirmation that there is a possibility that the Democrats might find a spine, that Senator Kennedy in particular might filibuster Ashcroft. And one of the things that's most egregious about Ashcroft, in addition to him being a racist, religious nut, and anti-abortion and so forth, is that he's a real drug warrior, isn't he?
Yes, he is. I look at people like this, especially politicians. Either they are incompetent or they are cowardly. And if they're cowardly, they understand what will work and what won't work. We have to be realistic. We've had 90 years of drug prohibition, 30 years of the war on drugs. And the questions we have to ask is, has there been any change in perceived drug availability or perceived drug use? And this is not the case. And see, Ashcroft is one of those people who just continue on. This thing, like I said before, has nothing to do with drugs. It's about power. It's about control. It's about coercion. It's about money.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are folks in the Republican Party, Schultz, the former Secretary of State, was one of the first Republicans who really caught my attention for advocating drug legalization. There's this libertarian strain within the Republican Party and folks who don't want to spend more money on prisons.
Yes, but you watch those people. They say all of this after they get out of office.
Right.
Now, just look at our former drug czar. I mean, not that he said this, but you look at the people who are leading the fight, the cause of the drug war. McCaffrey had the nerve to say, after he was out of office, or 3 weeks before he left, that he did not realize that the policies in place were affecting African Americans the way in which they do.
He said that the evidence that he had as the drug czar at the end of his term was that we should spend more effort on prevention and less on drug law enforcement. It's like, for God's sake, you know, you've been excoriating everyone who was talking about drug policy reform for your entire term in office.
Right, exactly. And see, he's been asleep at the wheel, or he's been a coward, or incompetent, or both.
Well, let's talk about the coward in chief of the last 8 years, which is President Clinton. He had the temerity to pardon a number of nonviolent drug offenders, all of whom were either personal family friends or major campaign contributors, but not to listen to the appeals for clemency for all the nonviolent drug offenders in federal prisons.
Wow.
And he also had the temerity to address the issue of the disparity between crack mandatory sentencing and cocaine mandatory sentencing guidelines at the very end of his term.
See, this is what I'm talking about. But he's always remind me of a big-time pimp anyway. I mean, I'm not being funny. I'm being very serious here. That's what he's always reminded me of.
Well, hey, he's something, man. He was...
You're right. You're right about that. But until we come to grips with this drug problem in this country, we're not going to solve most of the problems. We're looking and acting like a dog chasing its tail. Now, I have to ask you, has that dog ever caught his tail?
I've been speaking to Cliff Thornton. He's the founder of a drug policy reform outfit here in Connecticut called Efficacy, and with his wife, Margaret. And you can find all about Efficacy at efficacy-online.com or www.efficacy.org. .org. Sorry about that. Yeah, of course, it's an org. www.efficacy-online.org. And tell us, what can folks do in the meantime? There's been some studies of drug policy reform here in Connecticut. Is there any movement happening in the near term here?
Well, yeah. What we're doing is we're mobilizing our forces. As I spoke to you earlier, I've done two radio shows prior to this. And let me just put it in context here. 2 years ago, it was very difficult to get in to talk to some of these legislators and some of the upper echelon business groups. Now they're calling more steadily, more readily to have me come in and at least talk about the problem, because what they're feeling is that there's a growing undercurrent among the lower echelon people that want change in this drug policy.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it. If folks, I'd urge you to check it out, Efficacy Online, and I really thank you, Cliff, for coming on, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.